Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Roddy Doyle's latest novel, The Women Behind the Door, is a powerful and moving mother-daughter story filled with struggle and redemption by the Booker Prize-winning author. At 66, Paula Spencer, mother, grandmother, widow, addict, survivor, has finally started to live her life. She has a job at the dry cleaner she enjoys. Her boyfriend, Joe, is a text away when she needs him, and her four children now have the healthy families and petty dramas that Paula could have only hoped for. Despite its ghosts, Paula has started to push her past aside. That is until her eldest, Nicola, turns up on her doorstep one day. She's left her family and has come to stay. She gradually confides in Paula the secret that unleashed this moment of crisis. Mother and daughter must untangle past memory, trauma, and revelations to confront what they mean to each other and who they want to be. Roddy Doyle is an author of 10 acclaimed novels, including The Commitments, The Van, Patty Clark, Ha Ha Ha, winner of the Booker Prize, and most recently, Love. The new book, The Women Behind the Door, is just out, and it's a great pleasure to welcome Roddy Doyle. Thank you very much for being with us. What a delight to have you here.
Thank you very much.
What brought you to want to write about Paula Spencer once again and write about this character at such a moment, not only in her life, but just coming out of the pandemic, a very specific time?
The novel starts on the 7th of May, 2021. On that day, I went for my first vaccination, my first COVID vaccination. I'd got an email or a text instructing me to go to a university campus about 4 kilometers from here, from where I'm sitting now. It was in a theater. And when I arrived, I mean, I'm not sure what the arrangement was in the United States, but in Ireland, people were called for vaccination according to their age. So I was in a queue with hundreds of people the same age as myself, and, you know, early and mid 60s, which in itself was a bit comical. A lot of lopsided people. And I wondered to myself whether I was actually in the queue for the hip replacements and not the vaccination, you know. So I was very, very impressed with the way the whole thing was operated. The tone of it all, the friendliness of the volunteers and the people who were employed there, the whole way it just streamed through. It was really, really uplifting, almost, leaving aside the vaccination and the sense that we're near the end here. But as I said, the vaccination was in a theatre. And, eventually the queue, I got into the foyer. And then I realised that actually the booths, for the individual booths where people were going in to receive their vaccination, were on the stage. And I had seen a staged version of The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, the first book with Paula Spencer in it, on that stage about 20 years ago. And it was strange going up. It was kind of ingenious because if I'd been asked where will we put the thing, it would never have occurred to me to put it up on the stage, because that's where the actors go, And yet this is what they were doing. And it did, the depth of the stage and the physicality of the stage, the way it had been reinvented. But I was thinking of Paula. And I think when I was driving home after it, feeling a bit elated, feeling, you know, the end is in sight, we're near the top of the hill, we'll be coming back down soon to some sort of normality, I began to wonder, how would she have seen what I'd just seen? And that's where the novel began to take shape. I began to think of her, because I felt I can now write a novel, because I think we're on the edge of a post-COVID world. I couldn't write a novel during the first year. Couldn't start a novel because it just felt that every day the present was a different thing.
Mm.
I felt, you know, we're on the cusp now of maybe some sort of stability, and I can confidently start writing about the present day. And it just struck me as a good way to start the novel. I didn't at that point. I just took the odd note. But I began to wonder about how she felt about this, how she was. I did a bit of homework, did the audition, found that, well, she's 66 now, the same age I am now. Where are the kids? Any of them living at home? How are things generally? The man she met at the end of the last book, does she still see him? What's he like? Does she have any new friends? How are, her sisters, her siblings, are they still alive or are they well? I began to, and answer some of the questions, leave some of them unanswered, and the book began to take shape.
The first part of the book is May 7th, 2021, is the timestamp, and the book goes to different time periods. But at the beginning, it is a look at her. We get caught up with her, and it's I just found it to be hilarious, the back and forth between her and this group of women that she goes with, because that's just a hoot.
Well, I gave her a new friend called Mary, who isn't in either of the previous books. Mary sees Paula at her lowest, really. Paula has just got off the commuter train, having been cleaning offices, which she has been doing as for a job. And she's physically so impaired that she actually has difficulty walking home. And Mary sees this and offers her a job, basically. There's a part-time job going in the local dry cleaning business. So she starts working with Mary. And Mary, to me, represents the energy that Paula almost needs to get up every day. The idea of going to work side by side with Mary is something to relish, not to dread. Because Mary is outrageous and she's funny. And the two of them just bounce off each other. They're like, the two men in the balcony in The Muppets.
Yes,
They're a bit
Statler
like
and
the female.
Waldorf. Yes.
Yeah, they're like the female version, the two of them behind the counter commenting on the world as it goes by and comes in, So, and they just love each other. So they're great pals. And I think it's a glorious thing for Paula to be able to share this stage of her life with somebody who she feels she can say anything to. They've nothing to hide. Mary just says, in a cruder way, I don't care. Whatever happens, whatever I say, whatever I do, I don't care. And a bit of that rubs off on Paula.
And Paula listens. I mean, that's key to this, is that Paula listens.
Paula, the formal education system, probably the society generally told Paula that she was stupid. And I think what was important to me when I started writing these books was to get across immediately that clearly she isn't. She keeps putting herself down whenever she thinks of something and she thinks it's terrific. She immediately puts herself down, or sometimes she hears the voice of her dead husband putting her down. But it's a fight that goes on inside her all the time. And it sometimes can be quite amusing. She's a very witty woman. She loves words. She loves messing around with words. When she's lying in a semi-fevered state, having had COVID, and she's lying in bed, phrases and that come to her that she learned in her geography class more than 50 years before,
Right.
and she has fun with them, So, I mean, one of the things, I mean, I was a high school teacher for 14 years, and one of the things that taught me very, very quickly that there are very, very few stupid people. Very, very few. Everybody is, depending on the measure, intelligent. Everybody. And Paula, in a way, part of the writing about Paula is Paula convincing herself that yes, she is intelligent, and that Mary sees that. Mary makes Paula laugh, Paula makes Mary laugh.
Roddy Doyle is our guest in this week's book show. The new novel is The Women Behind the Door. It is published by Viking. So then we meet the eldest child. It's her daughter who comes, and this is really where I mean, obviously this mother-daughter relationship is key to this. And I'm curious as to what you wanted to explore with these two women and the precarious position that they're put in, which is, I think, ultimately a surprise to both of them.
There were a few things going on there. Some years ago, I'm not sure how long ago, a good bit before COVID arrived to entertain us, I was at a funeral. And like Nicola, Paula's daughter, I heard a man referring to his niece as she walked by, and he said, "She's hot." It was at the in a pub, in a bar after the funeral itself. And I was really, also appalled, stunned, shocked. Did I hear that? And I wasn't in a position to do anything about it because it was a funeral. The young woman herself didn't hear it, and I looked around, her parents didn't hear it, but I heard it, and the person sitting beside me heard it. And I was kind of powerless, but it lingered with me. And at some point, I thought, well, if there's an opportunity to use that, I'll use it. So I eventually did. It struck me as being a very powerful part of a plot if Nicola heard her brother-in-law say that about her daughter, her 15-year-old daughter, as she walked past him. And Nicholas hears him and sees him say it and doesn't do anything about it. And I think that spins her back to her own teen years and her father looking at her in The Woman Who Walked Into Doors, the first book. And I just saw it as an opportunity for the two women to sit and have, I suppose, at times an excruciating conversation. And this was where COVID, which had such an awful period, but as a novelist, when I decided if Paula tells the world outside that she and Nicola have COVID and therefore they have to be quarantined in the house, just the two of them, for 10 days, that struck me as being, and I use the word in an Irish kind of context, brilliant. I just thought, oh, geez, that's a good day's work. I was delighted because it was almost as if I could just see the two of them sitting on chairs and talking. Now, that's not what they do. It's a bit more fluid than that. But, and the rest of the world is kept at bay. The interruptions are only in texts and WhatsApps, but they can't get into the house. So it allowed that opportunity for the two women, mother and daughter, and a daughter who has really mothered the mother for decades. And I see Nicola almost like she puts on her armor every morning. Now, whether the armor is makeup or the way she dresses, all of it, she puts on her armor, she goes out and faces the world and wins. And she's taken off the armor and she's very vulnerable and shattered, distraught. And now it's her mother's opportunity to be the mother. And she sees it as an opportunity, but she dreads it too. And she resents it and all the complicated features. And that's where the thinking was. So most of the work really was the two women facing each other and talking.
You talk about those complicated reasons. I think what's so fascinating about the two of them is they both have their moments where they there is such at least on the surface such a hatred between the two. They say just the nastiest things to one another as if to inflict as much harm once because that armor is off. That they're going at it, and yet it in a split second, the love appears out of nowhere.
Well, there are revelations in within the conversation that, I use the word excruciating because I can't think of a better one. Nothing that you'd want to hear. And yeah, so they go at each other. But Nicola is finally losing her temper about something that happened more than 30 years before. And Paula knows that she has to kind of bare her chest and take it. And if she allows herself to do this, they'll mend. That's where I love the contradictions of the average human being and the complications and Comedy and tragedy are so close to each other, and that's where that's the stuff of the conversation. And it's a strange one, really. There's a certain guilt in writing about it because it's a conversation you wouldn't in any you wouldn't want yourself, and you wouldn't want to inflict on other people. But from the novelist's point of view, it's kind of great.
It's fertile ground.
Very, very, very much so. Yeah. And I think one of the great things about, again, who wants to get older? I can't think of anybody I know or knew ever who said, "Oh, I love getting older. It's brilliant." Nobody wants to get older. But again, from the novelist's point of view, it is rich. The camera angle changes somehow. Like I'm the father of three children, but they're not children. So you look at it differently. You got, if a child on the cusp of middle age, it's bizarre in some ways. And my mother in her last years, she loved to go to the cinema, and she went with my elder sister, and the two of them showed their pension books because they got a reduction going in. So, two old age pensioners, mother and daughter. I mean, it wouldn't have happened 100 years ago because one of them would, at least probably both of them would have been dead by now. They've gone way past the life expectancy for 100 years ago. But I suppose it's the modern world. So, Paula is 66, but she's still very vibrant. She still has an active sex life. She's still curious. And then she's got her daughter, who's trailing along behind her somehow or other, and a very different kind of person. But there are things that have never been admitted. And of course, the daughter has been a brilliant nurse, a brilliant helper, a brilliant, almost like a mother. And that has to there has to be a resentment brewing away there. So when they start to, they let go. They really do let go. And it's probably for the good. The honesty produces what will probably be, because when the novel ends, and I haven't thought past it. How are they now? They don't exist, so I don't know. But the novel ends, I would have thought, hopefully, they will. I mean, Paul is now anxious about her daughter in a way that she probably usedn't to be. And that's probably quite a healthy thing.
And the mother and daughter have more of an understanding about each other.
Yes, I think so. And it's funny, the daughter now, a woman, she's got two children in their 20s and a teenage daughter, three girls. And she's moving into a house. She's going to live in a room. She's renting a room from two other women who are living in the house. I mean, it's an area close to where I am sitting now. And in a way, she's living the life of somebody in their early 20s, not in the sense of going out and going to gigs and,
Right.
partying, but it's almost like she's living her life backwards, catching up in the way on things that she never had. And, that kind of period of independence, that's what she is, I suppose, exploring by the end of the book. But it's a strange, I would imagine, for any parent to see a child going from the comfort of good job, good house, great kids, very considerate husband, it would seem, and to walk away from that. To do something else and to do something that seems almost childish, Paula has to kind of respect that and let it happen.
Roddy Doyle is our guest on this week's book show. The new novel, The Women Behind the Door. I'm the youngest of five boys, so I never went through this, but I've witnessed it now with my wife and her mother, and I will never understand the mother-daughter relationship fully. It's a very complicated relationship that you seem to really put your finger on in a way that I find to be quite striking.
I had a mother, had two sisters. They were older. I've a daughter. I see her with her mother. I've seen other women with their mothers and mothers with their daughters. And I don't know if I'm any more observant or less than other people, but I think it's when you're writing a novel line by line, particularly when it's a character like Paula. You know, there are things I have in common with her. The age, we're both similar in age, both grew up in the same part of Dublin, so the geography is familiar to me, and these things help. But there are huge differences, like she's an alcoholic, I'm not. She's a woman, obviously, I'm not. But so you have to be very careful. Every line has to be carefully examined. And I do that anyway, and when I'm writing anything, but I think in these books particularly, I have to be very, very careful. But I think about it quite a lot. I was a high school teacher from 1979 until 1993. And I was in a school called a community school, a bit like the British comprehensive system. It was co-ed and it was multi-denominational. And this in Ireland was revolutionary, really. The notion that, in theory, anyway, Catholics and Protestants and atheists could be educated under the one roof, and then boys and girls could be educated under the one roof. I suppose it's conventional in the United States, but it wasn't. And the school was only 4 years old when I went into it, so it still had the, you know, the smell of fresh paint. And to me, the revelation, and it was a glorious one, was the contrasts and the similarities between the boys and girls. You know, if it was a group of kids and the class sizes were huge in the early 80s, it got smaller and smaller, but you know, I'd be a class of 38 children, which is a lot. It's a lot of names to remember, you know, very quickly. Although it was easier, you know, like half the girls were called Jacqueline, you know, like then all these teenage girls called Jacqueline because of Jacqueline Kennedy. But if there were two or three girls who were very keen to do well in, say, the state exams at the end of the year, they kind of dragged the rest of the class behind them. They were amazing, the energy they would have and the power and their ability to actually control the class almost. I always knew if there was a couple of girls who were up for it, so to speak, that they, not just that they liked, say, I taught English, not just that they liked reading a particular novel, but that they were keen to write a good essay. They were keen to look at any remarks I wrote at the end of the essay. They'd ask me questions about it. And that kind of diligence, I suppose, rubbed off. And like, but you know, the boys, you know, they were kind of cowed by the girls. It was just, it was marvelous. Because I went to an all boys school, the Christian Brothers, kind of rough place. Girls were suspect, you know, warned against girls. They're only a distraction. Don't go near them. You know, this is the world, Holy Catholic Ireland that I grew up in. And then to stand at the front of a room and observe this glorious life and the intelligence, and it had a huge impact on me. And I think I often still, I'd always feel grateful for it. But even, you know, I left teaching 31 years ago, but sometimes it feels like yesterday because it still informs a lot of my thinking.
So I was fascinated by this, and it's just because I had a great mom, and just a wonderful mom. But man, you know, I never swore in front of her, and to have these two women, just the profanity that you have just you have it to an art form, sir. I just it is amazing. And what is woven together of these two women talking to each other is just lovely.
God, great, great. Well, you know, that's Ireland, that's Dublin. My mother wasn't fond of what she called bad language, but when it was well, how would you say, when it was well timed or well presented, she would laugh. My father had a gift for inserting the expletive in exactly the right place and in the right tone. So I think I certainly learned a bit from my dad, so to speak. But it is the, it's the rhythm of working class Dublin. You know, it's in the speech pattern. You know, some people can't go two or three syllables without inserting an expletive. It just, there's rarely violence in it. but there can be. So, when you just, it's would I be capable of writing dialogue without it? Yeah, but it would depend on the characters. And I'd feel, in the case of most of the characters in this particular book and other books, if I was to sort of rinse it a bit and make it a bit more palatable or a bit tidier and nicer, it wouldn't be as good, So it has to be there. I remember when speaking to Alan Parker, he directed the film of the novel, The Commitments, that I wrote. And he said when he let the cast, these young musicians from Dublin, none of them were, very few of them were professional actors. They were mostly musicians. And he said when they let, during the scenes, when he let them go, so to speak, he said there were way more expletives than there were in the actual script. Like I had undercooked it, so to speak. They threw the they threw the ingredients back into the pot. So I'm not inventing anything, so to speak. I suppose, yeah, my books have a certain rhythm that unique that's uniquely mine, but and all dialogue, no matter how realistic it seems, it's all a bit heightened, it's all edited, so to speak. But I do like to think that the when a character says something that people might be shocked by, it's because that particular character, Paula or Nicola or Mary or whoever else is in the book, would speak that way. Joe, Paula's boyfriend, I suppose we could call him, even though he's in his 70s, he would rarely, if ever, use bad language.
The Women Behind the Door. The book is published by Viking. Roddy Doyle, it's always a delight to speak with
Thank
you. I
you.
thank you so much and so
Thanks. That
enjoy
was.
our conversations.
Thank you very, very much.
Roddy Doyle's new novel is The Women Behind the Door. It is published by Viking. Thanks to our producer, Sarah LaDuke. Write to us at book@wamc.org. The latest on national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter at wamc.org and on social media at WAMC Radio. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.